supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Green Party candidate Jill Stein's effort to secure a recount of Pennsylvania's presidential vote continues, with filings in both federal and a local court. Details from WHYY's Dave Davies.
Stein's campaign lawyers have been asking for a recount and a forensic exam of voting equipment because they say Pennsylvania's vote could have been hacked by a foreign power. They took that case to federal court, saying in their complaint the state's voting system is, quote, a national disgrace. The filing also said the methods open to voters seeking a recount are labyrinthine, incomprehensible, and impossibly burdensome. What does that mean?
Well, creating tariffs and fees for voters to challenge the system.
That's Jonathan Abbity, one of Stein's lawyers. The complaint says while other states permit candidates to seek a recount relatively easily, Pennsylvania requires petitions from large numbers of individual voters who face confusing requirements and procedural deadlines that may not even be public. Stein attorney Ilan Mazel met with reporters outside the court and said the requirements Pennsylvania imposes amounts to an unconstitutional burden.
When the election code makes it impossible for you to seek or extremely difficult for you to seek recounts, then you don't know if your vote was accounted. And voters have a right to make sure their vote was accurately counted. If you don't know that, you don't have democracy.
The Stein campaign has to make a constitutional case to justify federal intervention in their battle for a recount. The heart of Stein's case in Pennsylvania is the voting system's vulnerability to hacking. And Mazel says many of the state's direct electronic recording machines are banned from other states because of security concerns.
DRE machines are easier to hack than an iPhone, which is crazy. They're vulnerable, they're hackable, and we need to make sure that those votes on those machines were counted.
The Stein campaigns managed to secure recounts in some individual precincts where voters petitioned local election boards, but officials have refused their request to bring computer experts in to examine machines for evidence of hacking. Republican Party attorney Lawrence Tabus says the Stein effort will fail in federal court, just as it would have in Commonwealth Court.
The court was going to dismiss it because they weren't able to show any potential issue whatsoever with respect to the machines in Pennsylvania.
Stein's lawyers say they can't present hard evidence of hacking unless they get access to voting machines to find it. But time is running out. The state's supposed to pick its presidential electors next Tuesday. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Schools in Upper Perkiomen, Montgomery County, will be back in session tomorrow. This after administrators canceled classes today as police investigated a potential threat of harm against students. Officials say there is no longer a threat to the district. WHYY's Katie Culinary reports the incident stemmed from a social media post. It included portions of a video about the warning signs of gun violence.
The public service announcement was put out by families of the victims of the 2012 Sandy Hook shooting and tells the story of two teens who become pen pals of sorts, writing notes to each other on a library desk. But the moment they finally meet, there's a chilling twist.
So you like to write on desks?
Yeah, that's what I do.
Another student, who's been in the background of the ad the entire time, appears in the school gym, cocking a rifle. This is the image in an Instagram post that prompted a state police investigation at Upper Perkiomen Schools early this morning. A screenshot of the post obtained by WHYY shows someone with the username Upper Perk is Cool wrote the words "See you next year" below the image of the gunman. The poster later claimed it was meant to be a play on the ad and not intended to be a threat. But some who saw it were concerned and notified authorities.
Maybe it was somebody who was playing some kind of, inappropriate joke, or maybe it was a cry for help.
Shira Goodman is with the anti-violence organization Ceasefire PA. She says while nothing is known about the intent of the post, those who responded to it did the right thing.
Sometimes people are afraid to overreact or to misinterpret. When they look back, maybe they realize there was a sign. And I think that what's so powerful about the video is, again, if you're paying attention to the wrong thing, you miss all these signs.
State troopers have identified the source of the post, and school officials are asking parents to talk to their children about the impact of their online interactions. Katie Colinari, WHYY News.
Longtime Philadelphia sports fans remember Vet Stadium, where the Eagles and Phillies played on artificial turf. Now, from the vantage point of the stands, it would take a very sharp eye to discern problems with the playing surface. A newly released investigative report shines a light on the leading maker of those playing fields who knowingly peddled a defective product. Joining me is study author Chris Baxter of NJ Advanced Media. Chris, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Tell us about this company, FieldTurf, and how you came to look into their practices.
Yeah, sure. Well, like, you know, any good story often starts. It came from a tip who someone who said, hey, you really need to look into this company and their practices over about the 8 years that they were selling what at that time was America's hottest selling artificial sports field. It was going in towns and schools across the country. Most of them were paid for by taxpayers. And they came with really lofty promises that they were the most durable ever made. They were going to be revolutionary. They were going to last longer than anything else on the market. And yes, they also came with a premium price tag. They were the most expensive fields that these towns and schools could buy, you know, and they started going down. Beginning in 2005, they started going down rapidly and became very popular.
And what evidence do you have that merely 1 year later in 2006, the owners already knew about problems but weren't sharing that knowledge with potential customers?
So our investigation, which covered about 5,000 company records, internal documents, court records, found that almost from the beginning, FieldTurf executives were aware that this turf was not living up to marketing and advertising promises, that it was already falling apart on some fields in about a year of use, and that they were having problems. And so there was a lot of internal email discussions from 2006, 2007, 2008, where executives are raising serious alarm and being very candid with the fact that this stuff is not performing and we need to do something, we need to change course, and yet that never happened. The advertising and marketing was never changed, customers were never informed, the company just kept on selling.
Did the product come with any sort of warranty or guarantee, though, that when the playing surface started to dissipate, there would be a recourse?
Most of these things came with an 8-year warranty that, at the company's discretion, would guard against premature deterioration or defects. Nearly 1 in 5 of these fields has been replaced under warranty because of problems. But what we found in our investigation was that the company never proactively, to this day, has never told every customer that bought this product what happened and how it breaks down and what to look for and what to do if they see it. So because of that, a lot of customers are still in the dark. And for a lot of these towns and schools, this was the first artificial turf field they had ever owned. So they weren't experts. In fact, many told us they relied on FieldTurf to tell them if the field was looking good or not.
Does it break down directly and exclusively in correlation with the amount of use? Are there other factors, specifically ultraviolet light or other environmental factors that cause the degradation?
Right. So if you were to go look at a field, the signs of this problem include, if you look at the actual fibers, they're cracking, they're splitting, they're becoming very hair-like. If you tug on them, they very easily break off. Where the turf was once sort of lush and full and green, it's very sparse. You see a lot of the black rubber crumb infill. FieldTurf says that the problem was due to a defect as a result of its supplier changing the chemical formulation of the material that was used to make the actual artificial grass blades. Now, the supplier has denied that fact. There was a lawsuit between the two. They settled in 2014 for an undisclosed sum of money, and neither side has ever admitted any wrongdoing. But FieldTurf stands by the fact that this was the result of ultraviolet light and premature deterioration because the turf was not properly protected from the damaging effects of the sun.
In practice, what recourse is available to those who play on or own these faulty fields short of litigation that might take years or decades to solve?
FieldTurf has put out a message to its customers in response to this story. And basically said, you know, if anyone has any concerns about their field or the condition of their field, to contact them. So that's certainly one thing people could do. We have also heard from folks that will approach state attorneys general or perhaps the Federal Trade Commission to take a look at the claims that this company made in contrast to what it knew and what it was discussing internally, but also just on a basic customer level. Our report at nj.com/fieldturf describes the problem in detail and would allow someone to go out and take a look at their field and decide for themselves whether they see those conditions and whether that's something they want to take action about.
Chris, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
My pleasure, Dave.
Chris Baxter of NJ Advanced Media. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Philadelphia has experienced some unusual spikes in overdoses and related deaths over the past few weeks. As WHYY's Alana Gordon reports, it comes amid a general increase in overdose deaths around the region and state.
Philadelphia police reported 9 suspected overdose deaths in Kensington alone between Friday and Sunday. 6 of the deaths being investigated happened all in one day. Roland Lamb is Philadelphia's Deputy Commissioner for Behavioral Health Services. He's awaiting more details from the medical examiner's office on the causes, but
in my history of being involved with drug treatment for almost 45 years, this is as bad as it gets. I haven't heard anything like this, with the exception of the initial outbreak of the fentanyl in 2006.
Lamb is referring to a really potent synthetic opioid that also has recently been cut into some batches of heroin. That can increase the risk of an overdose, often without a user knowing that the heroin has been altered. Jose Benitez is director of Prevention Point. It's a public health group and syringe exchange located in the heart of the area where many of the overdose deaths happened. He says one day about 3 weeks ago, there were some 50 overdose incidents, including 5 deaths. He says one way they're trying to combat the problem is distributing more naloxone kits.
So 2 or 3 weeks ago, when we had the 50 overdose incidences, we gave out 75 naloxone kits to high-risk people in a day, and that is a lot.
If naloxone is administered soon enough, it can reverse on the spot a potentially fatal overdose. Benitez and Lamb both say one challenge is the high cost of the kits. They're about $75 for a pack of 2. Lamb's department has already paid in excess of $500,000 for kits and training on how to use them this year. He says it's not enough. The mayor's office recently announced the creation of an overdose task force. Benitez says he's hoping that will produce a more organized, real-time response mechanism for when people catch wind of these spikes. Philadelphia, meanwhile, is on pace to have more than 700 overdose deaths this year. I'm Alana Gordon, WHYY News.
Kids in Burlington County are getting what local officials hope is a different perspective on police. Part of a program that brings cops and teens together for an evening of discussion, role play, and pizza. As WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, it aims to change kids' opinions of officers amid a national conversation on policing.
We're in a plain carpeted room in a government building in West Hampton, but what's happening inside could just as easily be taking place outside on the street. It's a traffic stop, except a kid is pretending to be a cop and a cop is pretending to be a suspect.
What do you want?
Excuse me, sir, could you roll down your window?
What do you want? What are you stopping me for?
Sir, could you please roll down your window?
Why are you stopping me?
Sir?
I want to know why you're stopping me.
I can't communicate you.
Why can't you? You're communicating me right now. Why not?
What? I can't hear you.
All right, here, I'll put it down a little bit. What are you stopping me for? What do you want?
The detective here is showing how challenging it can be when the person who's been pulled over gets agitated. 17-year-old Carlos Davila was playing the police officer.
Like, if you stop somebody and you're angry and you're coming at them some type of way, they're going to feel some type of way and they're going to get on the defensive. And then that can cause the stop to be a little, it's going to be bad for everybody there. But if you approach it more, like, calm and a little bit more, you know, it will loosen up the person and they won't feel as on guard.
Davila is part of the third class of Burlington County's Police and Teens Together program. It started in September, and about 55 kids have gone through so far. They're recruited through schools, houses of worship, and local nonprofits. Sheriff Jane Stanfield says the program was started in response to growing distrust of law enforcement across the country.
This isn't a local issue. This is a national issue, but it's what's being put on the media, what the kids are seeing, whether it's YouTube, whether it's other things, emphasizing some of the negative side of law enforcement. We want them to see that, hey, there's two sides to every story.
During another part of the night, police show kids a video of a traffic stop that turns deadly. An officer begins to pat down a driver who had been pretty cooperative when that driver pulls out a gun and shoots the officer several times, ultimately killing him.
What was your gut feeling? Like, what did you see?
I just felt like it all could have been avoided if he just would have told the truth and said, oh, I have a gun. I mean, you might have gotten arrested, but killing somebody, it makes no sense. There was no.
Amy Dean is the director of Faith in Action, a nonprofit partner of the Police and Teens Together program. She says the introduction alone between cops and kids will mean their interactions will be better off in the future.
I think now some of the officers will see some of the students at schools or on the streets, and they can actually speak to them and say, hey, Officer so-and-so, and there's a smile. Whoa, a serious exchange, whereas usually kids will kind of like, oh, you know, the police, and they'll run or they'll just go away or roll their eyes, stick the middle finger up, whatever it is.
For 17-year-old Davila, it means not only knowing the officers, but seeing the world from the other side of the badge.
You know, you never know where people can come from if, like, it's a dangerous situation. You got a lot of on-the-spot decisions that you have to make. And it's really hard. I was struggling that year.
Next year, the sheriff's office is hoping to partner with individual police departments in Burlington County. That way, cops will be able to meet kids on their turf and not the other way around. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
All right, sir. You got all your information in the system now. We're just going to give you a little fine. You'll have to pay, and then you'll be on your way.
Reality mars the romance of A Rendezvous with Mars. Let's burst some bubbles with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, we have this goal in mind, man mission to Mars. Not so easy.
Not so easy at all. If we look at the history of Mars missions, which include orbiters and robot explorers being launched from different countries around the world, what we find is that the United States has been extraordinarily lucky in its ability to get almost every one of its landers on the surface safely. That's not true of other countries around the world for whatever reason.
And when we're considering a manned mission, of course you want to minimize that luck factor.
Yeah, you want to minimize that luck factor, reduce the risk as much as you can. But National Geographic actually has a television series on right now called Mars, in which they do two things. They juxtapose our knowledge and ideas, concepts, and sort of dreams about going to Mars as we see it today, with a fictional story of the first explorers to go to Mars, in which a group of six, I believe it is, goes to attempt a landing on Mars to establish a base for exploration. And even before they land the spacecraft on Mars, the calamities start to pile up. So this begins to illuminate how, it is said by others, Mars will try to kill humans in 1,000 different ways.
Should we put men and women in potential harm's way, or can good science be done with rovers?
Oh, great science can be done with rovers. There's no question about it. In fact, there's a very strong argument that there's no need to send humans into space to explore at all because the risk is just too great. The benefits that can be gathered by robotic spacecraft are high enough that it doesn't warrant putting humans at risk. Space exploration is inherently challenging and hard. All we've done is to throw huge amounts of dollars at minimizing the risk to the greatest degree possible and taking the most careful steps in space exploration that we can with the least amount of risk. Now, everyone knows that I'm a big romantic advocate for space exploration, human space exploration. Yeah, that's true. But I also am not looking at this through rose-colored glasses. It's all a game of how do we minimize, how do we drive risk as close to zero as possible for human exploration.
Regarding that night sky, 'tis the season, but which season?
Right. Well, if you're out observing, you might notice that we can see the constellations of three seasons. If we look over to the west at 8 p.m., we can still see the major summer constellations, Cygnus, Lyra, and Aquila the Eagle. If we look directly overhead at that time, we can see the Great Square of Pegasus, which is the main constellation of the fall sky. And over in the east, just 15 to 20 degrees above the horizon at that same time is the main constellation of winter, Orion the Hunter. So we have a wide variety that shows us that time is passing, an interesting way to see that the year is progressing with the summer constellations over on the west heading down for the season, our main constellation for this season overhead, and winter making its way up in the east. And if perhaps you're looking for some sort of interesting astronomical holiday gift, the Delaware Valley Amateur Astronomers has their annual astronomy equipment and accessory auction coming up this Friday at the regular monthly meeting at the Radnor Township Municipal Building. And it's a great group to sort of peek in and see what they're doing while you find some interesting astronomical gift for that special starry-eyed person in your family. You can find more information at their website at dvaa.org.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
If you find Earth boring, just the same old, same thing. Come on, time up without a space.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
You find